This is a simple game. You throw the ball, you hit the ball, you catch the ball. You got it.
Now, the show that Red Sox Nation turns to first. This is Boston's most listened to nightly baseball show, The Baseball Reporters with Tony Maz.
Brought to you by Jordan's Furniture, Bing Y World Class Market, Brennan Smoke Shop, Rodenheiser Plumbing, Heating, AC and Electric, Ron Bouchard's Auto Stores, Advanced Auto Parts, U.S. Marker Board, Boston Volkswagen, Gravely Zero Turn Lawnmower, Foxwoods Resort Casino, Jackson Lumber, and Mass General Cancer Center.
On Boston's home for sports, 98.5, The Sports Hub.
And Springer, the batter, 0 for 2 with a walk. 16 home runs, 40 runs batted in for Springer. That's a high fly ball, center field deep. Betts back all the way to the bullpen, and it is gone. Oh. And in a blink of an eye, the Astros have the lead in the eighth inning.
That was a bad decision. That was a bad one from the get-go. That's the best lineup in baseball. He goes seven. Every pitch is high leverage. You know, he did his job. You know, the whole thing about one hitter, get him out, what's the point, you know? And we have the best player in baseball right now with a minute second and no outs. That's on me. That's not on Rick. So I just made a bad decision, put him in a bad spot, and we pay the price. I honestly think that seven was, you know, should have taken him after seven. You know, it's not because of what happened, you know? I just put him in a bad spot there. He doesn't deserve to lose that game.
It's on me. You know, he's got the confidence to lead me out there, and I got to do a better job of, I guess, rewarding that confidence. You know, it's 100% on me. The pitch count was intact. That was fine. I got to make a better pitch. Threw the two worst pitches of the night to back-to-back hitters, back-to-back pitches, and that was the result.
Okay, so here's where we're going to start. We're going to turn the clock back to Friday night. Red Sox lose a 3-1 decision of the Houston Astros at Fenway Park, and then we'll catch you up from there. Obviously, we haven't had a show here in a few days. The Red Sox have played four games since then, so we'll try to catch up on all of it here on the Baseball Reporter. 617-779-0985. I'll ask our producer, Jimmy Stewart, if he could open up the phone lines right away. Jim Murray is alongside as well. We'll take your calls on all things baseball here, starting with your own Red Sox, who lose 2 of 3 to the Houston Astros over the weekend. Okay, so I'll start with the big picture, and then we'll get to the specifics of Alex Cora's decision to bring Rick Porcello back into that game on Friday night. In fact, you know what? Now that I think of it, let's just go in chronological order. How about that? The Red Sox are leading 1-0. 1-0 going into the eighth. Rick Porcello has pitched masterfully to that point in the game. I think he has thrown 91 pitches, if I remember right, Jimmy Stewart.
Yeah,
and
that's correct. Yeah.
Yeah, I was going to say Jimmy and I discussed this, but I'm pretty sure it was 91 pitches. And Cora sends Porcello back out for the eighth inning. In the span of then four pitches, Porcello goes ball one, strike to make it 1-1, then gives up a double to Jake Marisnik on the next pitch. George Springer hit one to right center field that most right-handed batters cannot hit. Absolutely smashes it out of the ballpark. Red Sox down 2-1. Cora goes to the bullpen. Then you're down 3-1 because Brazier gave up another run. You lose the game. As a result, you lose the series because that really was, as it turned out, the swing game or the swing moment in the series. So, Murray, let me ask you, do you blame Rick Porcello, as he said, taking the blame there? Do you blame Alex Cora, and why or why not?
Well, it's tough. I mean, I'd like to think that Porcello could get out of that kind of jam, but ultimately, knowing the numbers, especially George Springer against Rick Porcello going into that game, he was hitting like .417 against him with a couple of doubles. It was a bad situation for him. Porcello shouldn't have seen that lineup at that point again in the game. You should be able to trust your bullpen, so I put it on Cora. But then again, if you're Alex Cora, how the hell do you trust that bullpen right now? So ultimately, yes, to answer your question, I think there's more blame on Cora out of the two, but I think both are complicit.
Okay, so I blame Cora. I do, and here's why I blame Cora. And Peter Abraham actually wrote about this in the Globe on Saturday with the headline, "Rare Error as Cora Gets Caught in Moment." Okay? And he says that normally Alex Cora would absolutely go to the bullpen right there. And you know what? I thought about this, and the more I thought about this, Cora got traumatized by the fact that the Red Sox bullpen last week crapped its pants. Listen to this stat that Pete Abraham had in the Globe. Porcello had faced a hitter for the fourth time in a game only once all season before George Springer came to bat. You get that? So only once all year had Porcello gotten to the point where he faced a hitter four times, meaning he made the turn to the order for the fourth time. He faced the leadoff man a fourth time, only one other occasion during the year. And there was this variable, too. The Astros, as a team entering Friday night, had a 1,048 OPS against starting pitchers after facing them twice, meaning on the third trip and beyond through the order, the team OPS of the Astros was 1,048. And yet, with at the time a 1-0 lead, Alex Cora sent Rick Porcello back out to the mound for the eighth inning. It took him four pitches to blow the lead in the game. So the question becomes, why would Alex Cora, who relies on analytics as much as anybody and has been proud to trumpet that, why would he do that? And you know what the answer is? Because his bullpen blew the lead in the first game against Colorado, and they lost. And then his bullpen blew the lead again in the second game against Colorado last week, and his team won anyway. So by the time it got to the Friday, the third game of the week, because remember, the Red Sox had had two off days. They played three games last week. The bullpen blew the first two. By the time they get to Friday, Friday was the third game of the week. By the time they got to the third game of the week, the bullpen had blown two in a row. And so Cora said, well, screw this. I'm not going to the bullpen. I don't have enough reliable guys out there. I thought Workman could be it, but he played a role in the Rockies series. I thought maybe Brazier was going to be it coming into the year, but he couldn't hack it. And he's proven to be unreliable. So the only real guy I have out there that I believe in right now is Barnes, who's been dominant. And even he has faltered at times here in the early part of the season.
He's too inconsistent. I mean, I thought you were going to say Walden. He's about the only guy that I think you could maybe make a
case. So Walden's been terrific. Walden's 6-0, but they've used him in spots that have been a little bit more on the conservative side overall, which has meant, you know, bringing him in when they're behind, what have you. And I think you'll see him get into some spots now that are maybe higher leverage. In fact, you've already started to see some of that. But the bottom line is this. Cora doesn't trust his bullpen. So then, Murray, to your point, why would I blame Cora if he wouldn't go to relievers that haven't earned his trust? And the reason is because I think Cora thought he could do it. In the early part of the season, he said over and over again, we're good out there, and now it's going to come down to us and matchups and putting guys in the right spot. And he thought that just between all the data and all the metrics that he could navigate his way through there. And you know what he found out? There's no substitute for talent. You can't navigate your way through there with guys who aren't capable of doing it. So that's what he found out. He learned the hard way. The Red Sox are short pitchers in that bullpen. And if you think that the Astros series means nothing, I've said over and over again, I'm not predicting what this will translate to in September and October. That's a fruitless exercise. We learned that last year. The Red Sox had a losing record last year against the Yankees, the Astros, and the Indians. They went 3-4 against Houston in particular during the regular season. They got into the playoffs and they beat them in five games, and they won all three games in Houston. But in terms of where they are right now, Houston's better than you. I think Houston really should have and could have, or could have and should have, swept that series. And they missed an opportunity to do so yesterday. And I'm just waiting for the first person to call and tell me, well, there's a real positive in that series. The Red Sox won and avoided a sweep. Because I don't believe that for a second. We'll kick off your calls tonight with my buddy Tom in Quincy. Tom, what do you got?
Hey, what's up, guys? Hey, Tony, I talked to you on Friday. And this series played out just like I thought it would. They would have a hard time against Cole. They had I think the kid pitching on Saturday, the kid Martin, the young kid. I never heard of him before. And then that Peacock kid was supposed to pitch yesterday, but they got Wade Miley. You know, whatever. Wade Miley, yeah, please. But so what happened was I figured that they would lose the first two games, and I thought they'd win the Sale game, which they did. But I'm not happy about the way they won. I mean, you know, Sale looked awful, to be honest. I mean, he had 10 strikeouts, but he walked five guys, which he never does. This is my thing. I think I've been calling you guys since last fall about the bullpen. So when people are looking to say, is it Cora's fault? Is it Porcello's fault? It's Dombrowski's fault. because he simply decided he's not going to spend any money in that bullpen because they were getting too high up to that luxury tax penalty or whatever. And he basically told Cora and said, this is what you got. Make it work. And during the playoffs, they went away from the bullpen guys altogether and started using guys, starting rotation guys on their off day to close out games and play, you know, late relief.
So, Tom, I'll tell you what, and I'm going to let you go just because I got other people lined up who want to get in. I don't think you're far off. I don't think you're 100% on, and I'll tell you why, just because, again, it's my opinion. I'm not telling you wrong. But I don't think you're far off. I think that they did want to stay below the $246 million threshold. I don't think there's any question about that. And they came in to the year with a number of like 238, 240, somewhere in that area. They're only about $5 or $6 million under that luxury tax threshold. They don't have a lot of room. So to sign Craig Kimbrell at a minimum was going to cost you eight figures. Okay, let's just say it was $10 million, and that's conservative. Because Kimbrell last year, I think, cost him, what, Jimmy, $13-14 million? Somewhere in that range, right? He was somewhere in that area. So you weren't going to get him for less than eight figures, which puts you over the 246. So forget Kimbrell. Kimbrell's out. And they didn't really do much else. They had some raises on the inside during the, you know, when I say on the inside, arbitration guys. Bogarts went up. Betts' salary doubled, et cetera, et cetera. They had to spend their money that way to keep the team intact. And then they signed a couple of guys to extensions in spring training, but that doesn't go into effect really until next year. And you know what I think they did really? Is when they were assessing the team and they had their meetings at the end of last year, I think they talked about it. And you know what Cora said? Don't spend the money on the closer. I can get by. I can manage it. We can do matchups. We have the information. We got guys with stuff. I'll figure it out. So if we're going to save the money in any place, save it a closer, because I will be able to navigate it. So, yes, it's on Dombrowski. No question about it, because they have money tied up in places that they shouldn't have money tied up. Some of that's his fault. Some of it isn't. But nonetheless, you look at the whole body of work and they said, no, you know what? We're going to take Steve Pierce back at $6 million or six and a half. We'd rather have Pierce teamed up with Mitch Moreland than give the money to Craig Kimbrell. I think Cora had a hand in that. And you know what they did? They overplayed their hand. They don't have enough help in that bullpen. And you can say, well, they didn't last year either. Fine, they didn't. They got to the playoffs. They were able to use the starters. This year, right now, they're in danger of missing the playoffs. It's early. But right now, they're out. Minnesota is good. So that's one more team that's in the mix that wasn't in the mix a year ago. Cleveland's a wild card team. Tampa's a wild card team. And obviously, the Astros have the best record in the game. So when you add all of that up, the Red Sox weren't expecting to have some of these issues. And against a team like the Astros, that's when your bullpen's going to show up. Those are the games you have to win. And Jim Murray gave me a great stat earlier today that should tell you everything you need to know about the Red Sox in that game on Friday night. And we'll get to Michael Chavis. And the home run he hit today in Toronto, the Red Sox walloped the Blue Jays today in Toronto. We'll get you caught up on Chavis, and we'll give you a stat that should crystallize for you the difference between last year's Red Sox and this year's Red Sox, at least to this point. That's next.
The Baseball Reporters with Tony Maz.
BackstageCountry.com, your online home for all things country music. Picking five of Carrie Underwood's best music videos was no easy task, but after some debate, we landed on five we believe rise to the top. Did Carrie's 2014 hit Something in the Water make our top five? Find out when you text Carrie to 45911 and scroll through the list on BackstageCountry.com. Text Carrie to 45911 to get your eyes on our favorite Carrie Underwood music videos.
We have the Sox covered. This is the Baseball Reporters. Tony Maserata, show that Red Sox Nation turns to first. 98.5, the Sports Hub.
Betts at third, Moreland at second. Here's the 1-1 from Jackson. Hard hit, base hit into left field. In to score Betts, in to score Moreland. And another hit in the clutch for Xander Bogaerts to put the Red Sox back in front.
So just real quick, Red Sox beat the Blue Jays today 12-2. Edwin Jackson was a starter for the Blue Jays, so you could say, well, you know, you're beating up on the bad teams again. I have a hard time getting excited about a 12-2 win over Edwin Jackson. Quick question. Jim Murray, Jimmy Stewart, quick question. You, the listener, quick question.
Yes.
Edwin Jackson, what is he? Answer, the class slut. This guy's been with everybody. Everybody. Class slut. Do you realize that this guy has now played for 14 teams in the major leagues?
You told me this earlier.
14. Yes, I believe it's a major league record.
It is.
14 teams. Again, he's been with everybody.
Call him Suitcase.
I mean, you know, again, if playing for any one team was like having sex, this guy would have all kinds of STDs. 14 people. Holy crap. 14 different teams. 14. You know what the amazing thing is? He was supposed to be good. He's only 35. When Edwin Jackson came up, I think he came up with the Dodgers. This guy was supposed to be like a stud. Stud. Here is who he has pitched with over his career. Tampa. And this is not in any order other than, I think the amount of games he pitched for each team. I'm not even sure that that is right. Let me check. No, he started with the Dodgers. Okay. So Dodgers, Tampa, Cubs, Nationals, White Sox, Diamondbacks, Braves, Cardinals, A's, Padres, Orioles, Marlins, Tigers, Blue Jays. Holy crap. 14 teams. In his career, the guy is 104-124. In the National League, 55-76. Everywhere he goes, he sucks and loses. How does this guy still have a job? So please, today, don't give me the Red Sox beat the Blue Jays and bounce back. All they did was mess around with the class slut.
That's like a AAA organization they got up right now.
Seriously, that's all they did. That's all they did was mess around with this guy. That's it, because he sucks. 14 teams. 14. It's unbelievable when you really look at it. Murray gave me a stat earlier, which I teased before the break. We'll get to him in 1 second here. Let me take a couple of calls. Cam's in Taunton. Oops, sorry, missed the button. Cam, what do you got, pal?
Matt, it's just, you know, I thought about this over the weekend, and I saw a tweet from you, from Matt McCarthy of you guys. It's right. Why is Thornburg still on this team?
Good question.
You don't have a better option down there in Pawtucket that's cheaper and can give up home runs every time he comes in. I think it's purely just Dombrowski not wanting to admit a mistake. I think that's all it is. I think it's the only reason why he's still here. What is his use? He's useless. He comes in and gives up bombs every time he comes in. And he's got thoracic outlet syndrome, so he can barely fill the ball to begin with. Can you just cut him and move on and admit that he made a mistake?
So, Cam, I don't know what's worse, the fact that he's still here or the fact that they don't think they have anybody better to add to the roster. And maybe they do, and maybe it's the thing that you said, which is Dombrowski's really just trying to still get something out of that Travis Shaw deal because they got walloped on that trade. And really, I said this about Thornburg earlier in the year because he had the reputation of having a great breaking ball when he came here. His fastball is as straight as any fastball I've ever seen. I mean, I'm talking about, it's one thing to have a really straight fastball and throw 97 or 98. It's another one to have a really straight fastball and throw 92. This guy's fastball is as flat and as straight as I've ever seen. It is just screaming to get absolutely pounded every time he throws it up there. Let's go to Dante, who's in Linfield on the Red Sox bullpen. Go ahead, Dante.
Tony, I'm telling you, I will die on this hill. They're pretty good out there. The bullpen is pretty good. They're not an issue. Everyone needs to realize, like, the bullpen is top five and at the very least top 10 in every single statistical pitching category out of the bullpen, including, I got a good stat for you. You'll like this. IRA percentage.
Oh, my God. Inherited
runners allowed. They're top 10. Top 10, top five in pretty much every main category. That doesn't sound like a problem to me, Tony.
So, Dante, do again, take the numbers out of it. Have you watched them in the big spots this year?
Tony, we said this all last year, and they performed well. They have guys out there with stuff who throw. I feel good about it. The statistics reflect that.
So, Dante, if they felt so good about it last year, how come they used the starters in all the big spots in the postseason? And I let them go. It's a rhetorical question. Listen, I'm not telling you these guys are all stiffs and that they don't belong in the big leagues, Brandon Workman belongs in the big leagues. I think Ryan Brazier belongs in the big leagues, and Matt Barnes certainly does. Okay? I just don't know that any one of them is really a guy that you can rely on in a high-pressure, leverage situation against a good team late in the game. And you know what? I'll still allow a little bit for Brazier there and maybe even Barnes, but they need more. The problem is they don't have enough. They don't have enough. And the biggest thing that Barnes has done this year, I know everybody's getting geeked up about the strikeouts. I keep saying this. The big thing is Barnes has thrown more strikes. He's not walking people. They didn't have guys last year that could throw strikes consistently. So you know what they did in the postseason? They went to pitchers who did. They went to Eovaldi. They went to Price. They went to Sale. They went to all of those guys, even Porcello, because all the pitchers, the starters are the best arms in the staff. So that's what they did. They went to the starters. Okay, and you know what? They're going to do the same thing in the playoffs this year if they get there. In the interim, I think they're going to need some help. So I'll tell you what, and again, that's Dante and Linfield who just called. Let's you and I, we can, you know, make a little gentleman's wager. We don't even have to put money on it. Just agree to disagree, and we'll see what they add at the deadline in July. Or we'll see how they approach the late innings in the playoffs if they get there. Let's see how that goes and see whether they go with the relievers that you think are good or whether they take a different approach, because I think they're going to make a change. Sean's in Whitensville. Go ahead, Sean.
Hey, man. Thanks for taking my call. Yeah, I was just calling about Porcello, and I think it's Alex Cora. I think that was his fault not pulling him out. I mean, I disagree with the other caller. I think that, they definitely need a little bit of help in the bullpen, and I hope that they do something before the deadline. And if they make the playoffs, I definitely do think that they need help in that situation, like you said, about the big spots where they're needed. They haven't really been there, and I hope that the Red Sox do something about that, because I think Cora was really like in a rut thinking that he wanted to stick with Porcello because he wasn't really confident in the bullpen.
Sean, they absolutely go hand in hand. Again, this is a team now that is relying on data and metrics more than it ever has before, and maybe more or as much as any team in the major leagues. Cora, it doesn't hide that. I mean, he spells it out for you. He says, with all the information that we have now, and he's not just going by the stuff that we're looking up on Baseball Reference. They have all kinds of data there relating to certain players against curveball pitchers or, you know, slider pitchers or certain pitches. Even they have all that data at their fingertips. And they even know that the difference in curveballs, a guy who throws a more, you know, the old 12 to 6, as it were to go, as opposed to a 2 to 8. Okay, you get the idea. Like, is it more of a curveball with more depth to it, or is it more side to side? What is it? They know all of that. And they thought they could navigate their way through it. And they can't. Okay, because they don't have the depth of arms out there that they need. They just don't. Last week, they blew the lead on Tuesday and blew the game. They blew the lead on Wednesday and won the game anyway. Then they got to Friday, and they had a 1-0 lead going into the eighth with all that data and a manager who typically doesn't let a pitcher face a team three times, let alone four, in the same game. Go through the lineup four times. And he sends Porcello back out there against the hottest team in baseball in a mistake that he admitted after the game. And you know why he admitted it? Because he knew he screwed up, and he also didn't want to say that he didn't have confidence in his bullpen because of the week they were having. So he backed off and went to Porcello, and it bit him in the ass. It took four pitches to blow that game. Four. Today, they scored 12 runs, which brings me to that statistic that Jim Murray gave me earlier in the day that I've been meaning to get to. We'll get to that and Michael Chavis after Murray gets you caught up on that.
BackstageCountry.com, your online home for all things country music. It's going to be a busy year for country superstar Jason Aldean. He's extended his Highway Desperado tour and is teaming up with Kid Rock for Rock the Country tour dates. We've ranked our top five Jason Aldean music videos. Text Jason to 45911 to see if your favorite made the list on BackstageCountry.com. Text Jason to 45911 and we'll send the link straight to your phone.
This is the Baseball Reporters.
Which makes all the sense in the world if you're the Red Sox.
With Tony Maserati, 98.5, The Sports Hub.
high fly ball left field. That's deep. Backing up McKinney. Backing up, leaping up. It is gone. He has struck again. Chavis with number 9. And the Red Sox open it up 6-2.
Another home run for Michael Chavis today against the Blue Jays. Again, the Red Sox won in a rout. 12-2 in Toronto. In case you're wondering why they played a day game today, this is known as... I'm laughing because I the whole thing I find amusing. It's Victoria Day in Canada. Murray, do you know what Victoria Day is?
Celebrates the Queen, I believe, right?
Correct.
Yeah.
Queen Victoria's birthday. Birthday, not like some, you know, this is not like some fight for liberty or independence. It's the Queen's birthday, Queen Victoria's birthday. So they, apparently it's the second to last Monday. I should have known this already because I'm sure that I covered one. I just don't remember it. So the Red Sox played at 1 o'clock today because it was Victoria. I don't know why I find this so funny. It was Victoria Day in Canada.
They got a lot of goofy holidays up
there.
Seriously,
like, could you imagine, well, I don't know, Clinton Day in the U.S.? Like, celebrating the birthday of Bill Clinton or Kennedy Day or Nixon Day?
It'd be a
like,
very sticky day.
Apparently it would, yeah. Careful, Mario. Yeah. So, in any case, they played a day game. Chavis hit another home run. Okay, so Chavis's performance thus far, indisputable how much of an impact he's had on the Red Sox. They are 17-9. When Chavis appears in a game, that's 8 games over 500. The team overall is only 3 games over. So that should give you plenty of an idea as to how they have performed when Michael Chavis has been here. And where Chavis has given the biggest bang for the buck is offensively. So Murray gave me this stat earlier. And you say the Red Sox, when they score 5 runs or fewer this year, are 6-20. Now, typically, the line of demarcation in baseball is at 4-5. You score 4, you lose. You score 5, you win. That's usually where it is in the modern era. That Red Sox record, when they score 5 or fewer, to be 6-20, is alarming. It really tells you how much they have to hit to win. And a lot of this obviously goes back to earlier in the year, too, when they pitched just dreadfully and dug themselves some big holes in games. Okay, 6-20, 24th in baseball in that metric. I mean, that's really low. Again, the record in and of itself is immaterial. It's where you rank because most everyone's going to have a losing record in those scenarios. To illustrate that, last year the Red Sox in such games were exactly 500. They were 46-46. So that should tell you half the schedule, more than half the schedule, you're going to score 5 runs or fewer.
Which upon finding out, and a buddy of mine sent me this, when I saw it, I was like, well, it's still probably pretty good. And then you looked that up, what they did last year at 500, and they were...
first.
Yeah.
46-46, scoring 5 runs or fewer, ranked them first in the majors. The point is that they still won those games where they didn't absolutely hammer people to death. Now, the Red Sox only lost, what was it last year, 54 games overall.
Correct.
So I, off the top of my head, I can, you know, whatever that is, I can, they went 60-8.
But comparatively.
62-8, I think, in the other 70 games.
That is correct. And comparatively speaking, you know, the Astros were the second best team in the American League, who went 103-59. And when scoring 5 or fewer runs, they were 50-54. So 4 games under.
Okay, so they were just a little bit under. But again, you're talking about the second best team in the league.
Yeah.
Right? So they were 1-2. And who was third, Murray?
Would that be the Yankees?
Bingo.
Yeah.
Okay, so again, the point is that if you can win when you don't score, typically that translates into success. Every team's going to win when they score. Every team's going to win when they score. But can you win when you don't get 6? And the Red Sox haven't won those games. So I just thought it was a very revealing stat, and obviously Chavis has had a profound impact on that because Chavis is a run producer. That's what he's done here in the early part of the year. If you listen to one of the shows last week, and I don't remember if it was Thursday or Friday, I'm not a big Chavis fan as a guy. As a guy. As a player, I love the production. We'll see how it works defensively. He made another error today on a play as routine as can be. Nonetheless, I would say overall the defense has been pretty good, especially for a guy who never played second base before. But the stuff off the field, boy, it feels like he's really impressed with himself. Saying that he had the answers you know, in terms of hitting in the clutch. He made a comment after beating the Rockies last week with that single on Wednesday night about how he had come to the plate in so many situations late in games with the game on the line, and he'd learned how to succeed based on what he had done in the minor leagues, blah, 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 blah. And I told you, I'm not a big fan of that kind of talk. I just assume a guy would come up, shut up, and hit. Okay, shut up and hit and make the plays. Let me be the judge. So when I really started thinking about it, you know what it was that got me off on the wrong foot with Chavis? It was a story that was written by Rob Bradford, who's covered the team for a long time, and I'm not blaming Rob. It was a good story. But I also wonder about what went into it both before and after the fact. So apparently there was a Twitter back and forth in which Chavis was on there expressing his religious beliefs. And he's very Christian, a devout Christian, and a vocal Christian, which is his right. Okay, I'm not, he can believe whatever he wants. I'm not telling you I question the beliefs or anything of the like. He is entitled to believe whatever he wants. But he was asked about the storm that he had caused on Twitter by tweeting about some of his beliefs. And he told Bradford, "It can upset some people, which personally I don't really understand. I think somebody's faith is their personal thing, obviously." And then this is the line that really sort of got me. "Given the platform that I have been given, this opportunity, I think it would be a waste if I didn't use it to try and spread the word." Okay? Now, I would argue, so your appearance in the major leagues and your ability to play Major League Baseball is a platform to you for you to spout your religious beliefs. And I just don't agree with that. In fact, I would say quite the opposite. Keep it out of baseball.
Right, shut up and hit. This is the Tim Tebow stuff. Like, enough, buddy. We get it. Like,
okay, keep it out of baseball. So what do we want to do? We want to create some sort of storm in the clubhouse or the locker room where every guy gets to spout his religious beliefs, and we're going to get into an issue that many people feel strongly, passionate, and often irrational about, and then you're going to create all types of stuff in there? So that's what we're going to do. So I saw this comment from Chavis early on. This was April 24th, and I said, you've got to be kidding me. This kid just got to the big leagues. He's going to start this? And there's another comment in there where he says, it's kind of a tough area for me right now, being the new guy and trying to find my spot in the clubhouse. I don't want to be a distraction for anybody. I'm still going to use my platform to praise God, and it's going to be part of my life. That's not going to change. I just have to make sure this doesn't become a distraction that shows up in the clubhouse. Bravo. And you know what I think happened, Murray? I think the team told him to cool it. That it caused this little storm on Twitter, and the team pulled him aside and said, hey, what are you here to do? Are you here to play baseball, or are you here to preach? If you want to preach, that's fine. It's your life. You can do whatever the hell you want, but you're not doing it in our clubhouse, and you're not doing it in our town.
And they'd be right to. You know, from a business standpoint, you don't know who that might alienate, let alone the guys that may alienate in the clubhouse. But in terms of customers, like, just stuff it, dude. Like, wait till your career's over. Just go out there and play.
So, look, there's that old line from All in the Family where Gloria's asked about Archie. And she says, well, you know, there are three things you can't talk to my father about: politics, religion, or anything else. So what I would say to Chavis is, like, look, you're a ball player. Act like a ball player. Don't act like anything else. So when he made the comment he made last week about, well, I was in the minor leagues and I understood, and, you know, from the experiences I had in the minors, it's a situation I was able to be successful in. I just heard blah, 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 blah. Talk about a guy who acts like he has all the answers. All the answers. It's a turnoff. As Murray said, shut up and hit. Shut up and hit. You become a Hall of Famer, you can say whatever you want. Until then, shut up and hit. Chance is in a car. Go ahead, Chance.
Hey, Matt, thanks for taking my call. On Cora, I think that a little bit more concerning to me than even just the decision to leave Porcello in the other night, it's just kind of the last week's worth have been a little bit of some head scratchers, starting with Sale, taking him out when it looked like he could have gone another 10 innings that night, then leaving Rodriguez in for a few batters too many the next night, and then Porcello Murray said earlier the numbers for Springer against him, but he was even a little bit off. It's worse. Springer career against Porcello going into that game is 10 for 19 with three home runs. I think that's definitely like an area where you got to start to look at some of those decisions and say that's kind of 0 for 3 right there. And I love Cora. I think he's an amazing manager, but that's just a little bit concerning to see those three in such quick succession.
Okay, so Chance, I'll tell you what, it's an interesting point. I didn't even go back that far, and I disagree with you on Sale. Because Sale had thrown 108 pitches that night, and you're talking about the 17 strikeout game. And I thought Cora did the right thing with Sale. Don't succumb to the 17 strikeouts and don't make it a decision based on emotion. With Eduardo Rodriguez, they had lefties coming up, so he kind of wanted to go with it there. But the Porcello one to me is indisputable. He, his bullpen let him down earlier in the week, and he asked the starter to do something he wouldn't usually ask. Jordan's in the bullpen. Jordan is in Cumberland on the bullpen. Go ahead, Jordan.
I wish I was in the bullpen. I got a question on two guys for you. Alternative options to JBJ and Thornburg. In AAA, you still have Rizny Castillo, who hit .300 the past two seasons in AAA. He has to be able to hit better than JBJ up here at that point. And second, what's going on with Jenry Mejia, who they signed this offseason? It seems like he has done pretty darn good in AAA so far. He has to be better than Thornburg. That guy sucks and blows, all the way. He's horrible.
So, Jordan, I'll tell you what. I hadn't thought about Mejia. I'll look him up. It's a good question on Thornburg. I don't know what they're waiting on there. The Castillo answer is very simple. If they add Castillo to the roster, his salary counts against the luxury tax, and they go over the threshold. Right now, his salary doesn't count. They took him off the 40-man roster a couple of years ago. So with Castillo, don't hold your breath. Not going to happen. The second they add him to the roster, they go over that luxury tax threshold, and it's not worth it. So my guess is somewhere along the line, Castillo is going to be a throw-in in a deal, assuming that the Red Sox pay some of the money, and maybe they'll get something for it. But until then, I even wonder if they can do that. Like, if they trade him to another team, does he somehow go on their payroll? I'm not sure he does. He probably doesn't. But in any case, he's not worth it unless the Red Sox eat that money. But your answer there is that if they put him on the roster, his salary counts, and they would have to pay a higher tax, and they don't want to do that. We'll wrap it up with your calls when we come back.
Boston's most comprehensive discussion of everything baseball. The Baseball Reporters, 98.5, The Sports Hub.
BackstageCountry.com, your online home for all things country music. It's going to be a busy year for country superstar Jason Aldean. He's extended his Highway Desperado tour and is teaming up with Kid Rock for Rock the Country tour dates. We've ranked our top 5 Jason Aldean music videos. Text Jason to 45911 to see if your favorite made the list on BackstageCountry.com. Text Jason to 45911 and we'll send the link straight to your phone.
The show that Red Sox Nation turns to first. The Baseball Reporters, 98.5, The Sports Hub.
Okay, typically at this time, we give you the big matchup of the game presented by Big Y World Class Market, serving the Massachusetts community for over 80 years. The Red Sox obviously played today, day game in Canada on Victoria Day in Toronto, and the Red Sox were victorious, 12-2 win over the Toronto Blue Jays, and David Price's return to the mound. Now I know why the Red Sox picked Toronto for David Price. I don't know if you guys saw some of these numbers.
Soft landing.
Is it ever? And do you know his history there?
It's phenomenal, right?
Like, okay. So I heard this on the way in and I looked it up. I'm sorry, Mario. I didn't mean to cut you.
No, all good.
So his career against the Blue Jays counting today, 22-3. And in that ballpark, he's 13-1.
It's the best win percentage by any player all time against the Jays and second highest win percentage by any active player against any franchise.
I mean, seriously, it's something about the mound there that he apparently likes. I don't know what it is, but I guess he's commented on it. Some of it is the opposition, but remember, he also pitched for the Blue Jays for a short period of time. In that year, they went to the playoffs and they acquired him at midseason. He's 13-1 in that building. and 22-3 in his career against Toronto. So the Red Sox picked him for a lot of reasons, got him right back on the beam. And make no mistake, this is a, you know, it's a big couple of weeks coming up for the Red Sox. They just lost 2 out of 3 of the Astros at home. So now they get Toronto for 4. They should be able to absolutely kick the snot out of this team. And then 3 in Houston, home for 3 against Cleveland. And then you go on a road trip to New York for 4, then Kansas City for 3, and then 4 more with Tampa. So you're going to play good teams here really for the next 2 weeks. Again, after this series, Houston, Cleveland, New York, 2 of them on the road. And they just got, well, they just lost 2 out of 3 to the Astros. They could have very easily been swept in that series. So certainly keep an eye on what's going on with the Red Sox here in the next couple of weeks.
And just as an aside,
yeah,
I noticed it today. That place is a dump, Sky Dome, or whatever the hell they call it now. And I know it's only like 30 years old, but they need to blow that place up and get a new stadium.
Yeah, it is. It's bad.
I can't even look at it.
Yeah, the playing surface, too. It was one of the only domes that I liked when they first built it.
Yeah.
And shortly thereafter, all the other domes I hated. But now you look at it, and they've had, I think, problems with the turf up there and all kinds of stuff. It really does. It feels like a dungeon now.
I went a couple of years ago. It's like a concrete nightmare. It just feels ancient. Yeah. It really does.
It's like a dungeon. That's what those places are. They're dungeons. They're airplane hangars. And that one used to be state-of-the-art, and it does. It feels way behind the times now. Jones coming up here. What do you got?
Well, I'll tell you what. David Price was so good for the Blue Jays in that ballpark that Toronto had to move him to the bullpen in the playoffs. That's nice. As dominant as he was in that ballpark, they still had to move him to the bullpen. We have some takeaways from the Eastern Conference Finals last night. What can we learn from Kawhi Leonard and apply to Kyrie Irving and the Boston Celtics? We'll start with that. We got some thoughts on the Stanley Cup Finals. A big round of applause for Jackie Bradley Jr. getting on the board today. Congratulations. May 20th, Victoria Day, and Jackie Bradley Jr. Day. So we'll get to that as well.
I mean, I'm eager to hear this take from Jones, and I'm not talking about Bradley Murray. I want to hear what we can take from out of Kawhi for Kyrie. This ought to be a good one.
BackstageCountry.com, your online home for all things country music. Picking 5 of Carrie Underwood's best music videos was no easy task, but after some debate, we landed on 5 we believe rise to the top. Did Carrie's 2014 hit Something in the Water make our top 5? Find out when you text Carrie to 45911 and scroll through the list on BackstageCountry.com. Text Carrie to 45911 to get your eyes on our favorite Carrie Underwood music videos.